Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Coming up on this episode of White Wine Question Time.
And the thing about going to a pornographic film, I discovered, is that cinemas normally like to sit quite not too close to the screen. But if it's a porn film, they're all in the front rows. You can't get into the front rows. They're all there, right, eagerly, right at the front of the cinema. I was doing a show last year with Dame Judi Dench at the Gielgud Theatre in Shaftesbury Avenue, and outside the theatre, queuing to get a ticket, I think it was queuing to get a return ticket, was Cliff Richard.
No.
Isn't that sweet? He was just waiting. I mean, he could have come on and said, you know, if you've got any tickets, we'll sort you out. I said, this is going nowhere. You're going nowhere. It was a £100 company. You keep the rest of it. I'm off. 8 years later, he sold the company for £70 million.
No!
And that was in the 1970s, when
£70
million was worth £70 million.
Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And my guest this week is an author of more than 100 books, a broadcaster, a knitwear designer, and a former politician. A celebrated raconteur, he's touring the UK with his one-man show, Can't Stop Talking. And when he's not on the road, he lives in southwest London with his wife Michelle, who he's been married to for 50 years after they met as students at Oxford. And they share three children and seven grandchildren. Having become well known on breakfast television in the 80s, in no small part thanks to his choice of knitwear, he's been a mainstay on television shows like The One Show, Countdown, Celebrity Gogglebox This Morning, and Radio 4's Just a Minute. He's also the host of the award-winning podcast Something Rhymes with Purple with Susie Dent, who he befriended after becoming the most featured guest in Countdown history, making more than 300 appearances in her dictionary corner. At 74, he remains as curious and as busy as ever, and proudly remains the world record holder of the world's longest ever after dinner speech. It was for charity and it was for 12 and a half hours. So this next hour should be a breeze for him. Let's dial him up, shall we? It's Giles Brandreth. How are you, sir?
Well, I'm well, and I'm older than you think. Perhaps I'm older than... I'm not older than I look, as my wife reminds me every day. I'm actually 75 now.
75?
And I'm conscious of... It doesn't matter. I would keep quiet about it, except I made a thing about it, because you mentioned my three children and seven grandchildren.
Yeah.
Well, the youngest of our grandchildren, who's six or seven now, seven... When he was born with a babyhood cancer.
Oh.
And he had a pretty rough first couple of years of his life, spending about a year in hospital, mainly Great Ormond Street Hospital for Children in London. But the good news is that at the end of last year, he had his all clear. And I thought, oh, this is a time for celebration and a time for saying thank you to Great Ormond Street. So I thought, I've got a 75th birthday coming up. Why don't I try to raise £75,000 for Great Ormond Street? So this is why I'm aware of when my birthday was, because it was in March. And we took the London Palladium Theatre and I invited theatrical dames that I know. I've been doing a show on stage with Dame Judi Dench.
You are familiar with many a dame.
I'm so lucky. And I invited a dozen of them to join me on the stage of the London Palladium. And we had the most amazing birthday party anybody could ever want, because these great ladies of the theatre came and entertained me and, you know, 2,000 and more people in the audience. And it was fantastic. And it really was the most magical occasion. And I can't tell you how remarkable they were. And they were mostly people of riper years, because you don't get made a dame when you're, you know, when you're very young. And I think the oldest, and you wouldn't mind me saying this, was a Dame Patricia Routledge, who played Hyacinth Bouquet on television. And she's about 94 now, and she came on stage, and the roar for her was extraordinary. But even, I mean, amazingly, Joan Collins is now 90. I know she wouldn't want me to tell you this, but it is has been in the press, so people do know.
It's not like you're acting her, Giles.
I feel ashamed now. She was sensational. She had this idea herself. She came on and performed John Lennon's Imagine to my grandson on stage. It was just
What's
just
your grandson's name?
His name is Kit, K-I-T-T. He came on stage. He was happy to be on stage. Obviously, I checked with him and his mum and dad that he'd be comfortable about doing this. And we showed, and he was very proud, we showed the film footage of him. You know, when you finish your chemo in the hospital, you ring the bell at the end of, you know, when you're, anyway, that we showed that on this. There wasn't a dryer in the house. And then on came Dame Joan Collins. We had them all. Dame Joanna Lumley, Dame Maureen Lipman, Dame Sheila Hancock, also 90. You name it, they were there. But to bring on the cake, because they all had to be photographed at the end. They wanted to be photographed on the end. And while they were being photographed, I thought, what am I going to do while we're photographing these dozen dames to entertain the audience? So I invited my friend Bonnie Langford, who isn't a dame yet, but I hope will be in the fullness of time.
It's only a matter of time.
And while the photographer was taking the photographs, she sang Flashbang Wallop. Oh, what a picture, what a photograph. And then I'd forgotten there had to be a birthday cake. It was my birthday, so I had a dozen dames, literally more than 1,000 years of theatrical history and experience on one stage at the same time. There they all were, and I thought there's got to be a birthday cake. And on came Christopher Biggins as a pantomime dame wheeling the birthday cake.
Brilliant.
So
that's a hell of a bash.
So it was. It was a hell of a bash, and I'm happy to say we raised and rather more than more than £100,000. So it was good for the charity. It was good for, well, it was good for everybody. It was lovely for the people in the audience. And it was just amazing for me. So I'm a very blessed person.
You really are, as is Kit and all that love him. That's fantastic news, really is. Please send
touch
him
wood.
Very best.
Of course, you have to go on taking your, you know, the tests every year and all that goes on. It was a very interesting experience as well, in retrospect. And I was so impressed by the people in the hospital. And, you know, if you are a parent with a child in a hospital like that, they expect one of the parents to stay overnight.
Yeah.
And it was quite a grueling year for them as well. But a good outcome. So what are we talking about? What's your first question? Probably the first question is, when are you going to shut up so I can answer the first question? You know, I'm doing this show. Wouldn't it be funny if I was the first person on your podcast who talked his time out and you hadn't yet put the first question? That would be quite funny. I said to my wife, I've been to Edinburgh lots of times, and I said to my wife, what are we going to call the show this year? And she said, I've got the idea. I've got the right title, Giles. I said, really? What is it? And she said, it's going to be called this year. The show's going to be called Giles Brandreth Can't Stop Talking.
She got it in one. So listen, how many shows are you touring this year before we get into my first question for you?
Well, I've taken on a little bit too much, I think, in some ways. You mentioned my friend Susie Dent.
Yes.
She and I, we do a podcast
Something
as well,
Rhymes with Purple.
Like, called Something Rhymes with Purple, which is all about words and language, which we've been doing now for nearly 5 years, I think. Mm-hmm. And as you said, thank you, we won the award, Best Entertainment Podcast. It's about words and language. And what I love about it, what we both love about it, is we've built up an audience around the world who call themselves the Purple People. And we just have fun. We meet every week, often on Zoom like this, sometimes in person. But we also do live shows, and we've been doing quite a few live shows in a theatre. Well, that's fun. So I've been doing some live shows. I've been doing some shows with Dame Judi Dench.
Yes.
We're doing one in Edinburgh. It's not worth talking about them because they always sold out. So it just gets people excited, and then they look up, Judi Dench, Charles Brown, sold out, irritates them.
But you two are something of a tried and tested double act, aren't you?
Well, the truth is, we've done it a few times now, and she's magic. She's 88 years of age. You wouldn't know it. We did one the other day at Hampton Court for a charity called the Queen's Reading Room.
That's
Queen Camilla
right.
is very keen on reading, on encouraging people to read.
But this is the Queen's Book Club, isn't it?
It is. It's essentially the Queen's Book Club. She started it in lockdown, and it's sort of grown and grown. And it's about spreading the joy of reading. And to raise money for the charity, we did this charity show. And we didn't expect the Queen to turn up, necessarily, but she did. We didn't expect the King to turn up, but he did.
In fact, he got there before her, didn't he? She was caught up in traffic.
You are right. Oh, you've got the goss on this. We were so relieved that he turned up, because there was the
VIP. He was a stand-in.
The VIP reception. And no Queen. But who came into the room but the King?
Yeah.
It was pretty damn good. But I'd already got lined up there on the stage, Joanna Lumley and Richard E. Grant, as my substitute, Charles and Camilla. In the event that the real royals didn't turn up, I thought, this is the next best thing. Goodness sake. And I must say, Richard E. Grant actually looks more like the late Duke of Edinburgh. You know, he walks around with his hands behind his back.
Do you know, Charles, the last time I worked with, and the only time actually I've worked with Richard E. Grant, was for our now King Charles. And it was to host a Prince's Trust birthday celebration televised. And I was doing a one-off edition of Blind Date. And I was playing Cilla. And the three men behind the screen hoping to be picked were Sir Roger Moore, Richard E. Grant, and Chico, an X Factor contestant that had been a former goat herder and stripper. And the picker was the late, great Barry Humphries as Dame Edna Everidge. Can you imagine what kind of a night
that was? I can imagine nothing more wonderful. You've got four of my, five of my favourite people. Where can I, is this on YouTube?
It will be YouTube. Yes, it is on YouTube, because somebody posted some stuff to me upon the sad passing of Barry Humphries. So I was reminded of it. But yes, it was brilliantly funny. And my goodness, that man has such good humour, doesn't he, Richard E. Grant? Roger Moore, I have to say, played a blinder on the night.
I will tell you my Roger Moore story in a moment, if we have time, because I want to talk this out and never get to your questions. Barry Humphries, I have to say, it was, for me, one of the two funniest human beings I've ever seen on stage. And I've been lucky enough, because I've lived a long time, to see a great many entertainers, going back to people of the generation of Bob Hope, live on stage. Barry Humphries and Ken Dodd, two very different entertainers, were, for me, the funniest people to see live. I saw Barry live in New York about 25 years ago, and I thought, I don't think I've ever seen anything more brilliant. It was a Dame Edna evening. He was a genius. And his sense of danger, that tightrope he walked.
Yes.
It was fantastic.
He was dangerously funny. And do you know what? It's so apt that you have just recounted him as one of your two funniest people. Because earlier today, I was driving, listening to an interview between Rob Brydon and Harry Hill. And Harry Hill was talking about the two funniest people he'd ever seen delivering comedy on stage. The first was Jimmy Tarbuck. The second was you.
Oh. Wow.
Does that come as a surprise? Because this takes me nicely. I've actually silenced you. Brilliant.
You certainly, I was never thinking of that. So, is this Harry Hill?
This is Harry Hill, comedian Harry Hill, which I really have to make this my very first question to you because it's intriguing. And, well, here we go. Are you ready, Giles? Here's your first question.
Yeah.
Barry Hill listed you after Jimmy Tarbuck as the funniest person he'd ever seen doing a comedy routine on stage. He said it was you recounting a phone call that you had out of the blue that led to you sitting on Lord Longford's pornography commission alongside Cliff Richard. And he had me at porn commission. I wanted to know what on earth happened and how you ended up on a porn commission with Cliff Richard and a host of other greats, by the way, a high court judge, I believe, two bishops and an archbishop, what the job entailed and when else you've had a phone call that's brought about the most unlikely of invitations.
Well, I'm sorry that Harry Hill has brought this out into the public domain, because I now know the occasion this was. This was a celebration, a benefit for Ronnie Corbett, and it took place about 25 years ago. And I don't know that one can now tell these sorts of stories. But since you've asked the question and Harry Hill has raised it, I don't think I have much choice. But to set the scene, there was a man called Frank Longford. He was the Earl of Longford, who was a Knight of the Garter, among other things. The Knights of the Garter, this is the oldest order of chivalry in the country. And the great and the good become Knights of the Garter, or indeed Ladies of the Garter. And he was appointed Knight of the Garter by Elizabeth II many years ago. He'd been a politician. He was a member of Clement Attlee's government after the Second World War, later a member of Harold Wilson's government. He was a Labour peer. He was also a prison reformer, a great social reformer. Lovely man, a bit of a frost at parties, though, because he liked to bring Mara Hindley with him.
What?
In that he believed in being a friend to the friendless. And, for example, he would visit prisons and he would visit people like Mara Hindley, one of the Moors murderers.
Yeah.
Because he really believed in it. He was a Catholic convert, I think. A saintly man, a very good man. And in the late 1960s, early 1970s, he became really obsessed with the scourge of pornography in our society. And he decided to run a campaign, well, to have an investigation of what damage pornography could do to us. And nowadays, interestingly enough, people would probably agree with him. But then, in the, you know, coming out of the free and easy 1960s, people thought anything goes and let it all hang loose, let it all hang out. Pornography, why not? Make it available to everybody. But he wasn't so sure. He thought that maybe it was debasing to the people, the men and the women, who were asked to be in the pornography, and he wasn't sure that it was good for people. But he wanted to do some research into this. And he set up this pornography commission, much mocked. He was called Lord Porn. I mean, he was a figure of fun. Anyway, he set up this commission, and one day I received a telephone call. And the voice said, "This is Frank Longford." And I said, "Pull the other one." And he said, "No, this really is Frank Longford. I'm setting up this commission to investigate the scourge of pornography in our society, and I've already got a bishop and an archbishop, a rabbi, and I'm looking for some younger people. Cliff Richard has said yes. Would you say yes as well?" So Cliff Richard and I, the bishop, the archbishop, the rabbi, we all gathered at a room at London University. Lord Longford welcomed us, and then he distributed the filthy magazines. And we sat there, the bishop, the archbishop, the rabbi, me, Cliff Richard, in a circle with Lord Longford, flicking through these disgusting magazines, going, oh, rabbi, look, one of yours, I think. Anyway, this went on for several months.
Would you discuss its contents, the ramifications? Well, what were the conversations as you sat there and pulled apart the pages?
We pulled apart the pages, merely that we pulled apart. We tut-tutted and we agreed that this, you know, well, to some people's taste, not to everybody's taste, but we had to sort of feel what was going on. We extended beyond that. We went out into the streets. And we went to see lewd films. I mean, I remember, and he had other young people. I remember going with a student nurse to see a film in a sleazy place somewhere off Piccadilly Circus. You know, it was called sort of Beat Me Twice or something. It was a dreadful title. And I sat there, desperately embarrassed with this student nurse. And the thing about going to a pornographic film, I discovered, is that cinemas normally like to sit quite not too close to the screen. But if it's a porn film, they're all in the front rows. You can't get into the front rows. They're all there, right, eagerly, right at the front of the cinema. And we were sitting at the back, the nurse and I. Of course, she, being a nurse, she'd seen it all before. But some of it was a bit of a revelation to me. Then we went to Copenhagen to reap the alien porn. We travelled as a kind of investigative trip.
Yeah, this was because at the time, I think, it was being advertised as Sin City, Copenhagen, the most permissive place on earth.
And that's exactly right.
That's right, isn't it? And apparently on the flight out, Lord Longford read the Bible and didn't lift his eyes from the page you've said previously. He said to you, "I am preparing myself for the ordeal we are going to have to face, Giles," as he nosed his way through the Bible.
You're absolutely right. I mean, I wrote about this in my diary and said, this is in the public domain. He did. And he was very sweet. We got the other end. And there, I think, was the British ambassador welcoming to greet us all. And I think he gave us all a fiver, or maybe even £10 in Danish kroner, which he said would be more than enough to see what we'd come to see, which was the live intercourse. He said, for a tenner, you can certainly get the live intercourse. You could, I'm sorry to tell you, you could get bestiality for a tenner. Oh, it's awful. The whole thing is awful. But what is interesting is that the press at the time was sending it the whole thing up. And now, with the distance of 50 years, we would take a totally different view.
Because he wasn't a bit, you know, he wasn't a prude, this man. He had previously taken you out for lunch and explained to you that, you know, he had a healthy enjoyment of sex because he was a horse rider, and he explained to you that people that ride tend to love having very active sex lives.
Indeed, and that he told me that on the day after he'd been with the Queen, being made a Knight of the Garter, because he said, you know, people like the Queen and myself, who are keen on riding, we do have a very healthy approach to sex. And he said, and I also, I swim naked. It's marvellous. He said, I don't think the Queen swims naked. The Duke of Edinburgh might, he said to me. I don't think he knew.
So this guy wasn't, whilst he had a very strong moral compass, he wasn't dyed in the wool as being kind of, you know, anti anybody being able to live and let love. This was about exploitation, the wider ramifications within society.
He was very much in favour of real love. And his anxiety was that people, as it were, who might be playing the field or having what was then called free sex, might be ruining their opportunities for proper love. He believed in relationships.
Okay.
That's what he cared. He was a very caring, thoughtful and sweet man. Of course, he was of his generation, of his time. And he didn't, he thought, and he wanted, for example, sex to be within marriage. He was a Catholic. That was his approach. So, but he also felt he had to go and see what was going on. So I do recall going to this sex dive with him, and where all the hostesses, and they were hosts as well, they were naked. As we arrived, the live intercourse was taking place.
Wow.
We sat there quite close to the front, I was looking mainly at my knees. Cause anyway, we suddenly realised that around, coming, descending on us, was this naked Danish dolly bird with a whip. And I was 22, 23. Lord Longford was 72, 73. And she was coming towards him with this whip when she was stroking his bald pate. And I could see she was going to land in his lap. And then there were lots of press photographers there. You know, it would have been click, flash, literally flash, wallop. And around the world would go pictures of naked English milord with naked Danish dolly in his lap. So he got up and left. I followed him. And he said to the press, a good line. He must have thought it out beforehand. I've seen enough for science and more than enough for pleasure. Giles, if you want to stay, do feel free to stay. I said, no, Lord Longford, I'll come with
you. Where was Cliff in all of this? Did Cliff get to go to Copenhagen?
No. I don't. No. Cliff didn't come with us to Copenhagen. Cliff came to the meetings in London, and I loved sitting next to Cliff because I'd never seen anybody who dressed as beautifully as Cliff dressed. He, the velvet jackets, the silk scarves, he was a looker. He still is.
He still is.
Funny
enough,
I reminded him, I saw Cliff the other day. What a lovely man he is. I was doing a show last year with Dame Judi Dench at the Gielgud Theatre in Shaftesbury Avenue, and outside the theatre, queuing to get a ticket, I think it was queuing to get a return ticket, was Cliff Richard.
No.
Isn't that sweet? He was just waiting there. I mean, he could have come on and said, you know, if you've got any tickets, we'll sort you out. So we sent a message out saying, Cliff, please come round afterwards and say hello. And He was slightly embarrassed. He said, oh, I don't think Judy Dench would want to meet me. So I met him in the corridor afterwards and I said, Judy Dench is looking forward to meeting you. Oh. And I said, as you go in, feel free to sing congratulations. But as he went in, guess what he did sing? Devil Woman.
Even better.
Yeah.
Touché, Cliff.
Yeah.
Touché, Cliff. So, I mean, obviously, that one phone call from the late Lord led to, well, you know, what an adventure, if nothing else. But when else has the phone rung with the most unlikely of invitations for you, Giles?
Oh, goodness. Is this the second question? This is quite a good test for me because with this Can't Stop Talking show, normally with a show, and I've done several at Edinburgh, Edinburgh's changed my life in many ways. I'm going to the Edinburgh Fringe for August and then I'm taking the show on tour. I prepare a show with a, you know, beginning, middle, end, a shape, on a theme. The last one I did was called Break a Leg. It was all about the theatre. I've done one about language, as you can, things that interest me.
Yeah.
But with Can't Stop Talking, my wife said, look, you do this radio show called Just a Minute. Maybe you should invite the audience to tell you what they, you go out there and blather
on. That's a
great
idea.
Maybe they should decide what you talk about. And I've been doing some pilot shows, and what I've ended up with at the moment is a menu. And I get somebody onto the stage, and I give them a menu with a starter, main course, and pudding. And they get an option. They can choose one starter, one main course, one pudding. And it does, so it means they get something different every night. So if they don't want, you know, they offered politics stories, theatre stories, royal stories. They can't have all of them. They've got to choose one. Though, interestingly, among the puddings is always a potluck. And potluck is where it's thrown open to the audience. And anybody in the audience can ask anything they like. And if their minds go blank, they have to call out any letter of the alphabet. And I'm then obliged to talk on something from that letter of the alphabet.
Oh, that's
But
a
I haven't
good one.
Got anybody choosing potluck yet. Because on the puddings, as well as being potluck and a variety of other things, poetry, for example, I put rough sex.
Well, that's going to get that's going to get an order every time, surely.
Yeah, now, that's the point. Everybody wants rough sex.
Well, I've just had a plateful of porn, so I can't take any rough sex right now.
No, how? Oh, I'm very relieved. So come to the show, and then you can order that if I choose you.
Okay, well, listen, let me park the second part of that question, and let me put this to the test. Let's see if your wife's onto something here. I'm going to throw something at you, and let's see how you roll with it for question number two. Despite having accrued a wealth of experience in so many pockets of life, can we talk about the experiences that would have, could have, or should have been? The missed opportunities, if you like. You once recalled, and I'm going to quote you now, when I was 17 and he was 16, Richard Branson wrote to me because we both edited school magazines and we met because he wanted to start a new magazine and begin a new joint magazine empire together. Anyway, I turned him down because I was off to university and planned to be Prime Minister, so I got that one wrong. When else has an opportunity like that fallen through your fingers, Giles?
Well, he wrote to me, Richard Branson, at school because we both edited school magazines and said meet up, and we met up at his parents' flat, somewhere near Marble Arch, as I remember, and he was a year younger than me. And he couldn't stop moving. He was jumping all over the place. He had long hair. And he was like a sort of baboon or a monkey, almost swinging from the chandelier around the house. I mean, he was just never stopped moving. And I thought, this fellow's got some vitals in his dance. I mean, he won't sit still. Anyway, he explained his idea, and I could see he was dynamic. And I was in some ways excited by being with him. But I said, what about university? He said, what about university? I said, well, aren't you going to university? He said, no, I'm leaving school. He said, you're going to leave school too? I said, no, I've done my A-levels. I'm going to go and I'm hoping to go to Oxford University. He said, oh, what, Oxford? What's the point of that? He said, did Winston Churchill go to Oxford? I said, I don't know. No, I don't think he did. He said, you know, did Joan of Arc go to Oxford? I said, no. No, I agree. He said, well, you know, what's the point of going to Oxford then? I said, well, you know. And it was clear that it wasn't going to work out. But we would have had a business together. And it's very frustrating. And something similar then happened to me again. Later, because I said goodbye to Richard. I do occasionally see him, and he's always very courteous. He waves at me from inside his
palace.
Beautiful, beautiful racing green Bentley. He lowers the window slowly. And I can really see half
like,
his face.
Here's what you could have had.
Yeah, exactly. As,
as
I'm
he
going
departs
down,
for his private island in the Caribbean.
I'm trying to find my way to the Circle Line. He is, exactly, on his way to his own Virgin Island.
Yeah.
And you can't believe it, you know.
Yeah.
And I can't even get a, you know, I try to mention his name. When I go on a Virgin flight, you know, I'm hoping to turn left instead of right. I begin to tell this story. They say, no, steerage with the rest of the people. But I think I'm not a business person. That's what I've decided. I had a very good friend that I was, that I knew at university. And we put on Sonne Lumière together. You know what Sonne Lumière is?
No.
Sound and Light. It's the French for Sound and Light. And Sonne Lumière was huge around the world and in England. Basically, you took an old building and you lit it beautifully with wonderful lighting. And then you got great actors to tell the story of that building. It still operates in Egypt. If you go to see the pyramids, they do a big Sonne Lumière there. It was huge in France. It was pioneered by a French person. And then it came to Britain. And I put on Sonne Lumière in Britain, which is why you haven't heard of it. It was huge. Until I became involved. We did the first one.
You were the kiss of death.
I was.
You literally turned the lights out.
I did. At Temple Newsom House in Leeds. And I think the local authority, litigation is still going on, even though this was 50 years ago. They're trying to get the money back that I lost for them. They kindly sponsored this Sonne Lumière at Temple Newsom House. I didn't realise it was out of doors. We put the audience under a roof, corrugated iron roof, in case there was occasional rain. We didn't expect hailstones. This is because I'd never spent August in Leeds before. Had I done so, I'd have realised it's part of the norm there. Hailstones. The rain we could have coped with. The hailstones. You could not hear the son for the hailstones clattering on the corrugated iron roof. You couldn't see the building for the rain sleeting across the stage. Total disaster. But the next year, we thought, let's go bigger. When you're in, just go dig deeper. So we went to Royal Greenwich, the story of Royal Greenwich, kings, queens, astronomers royal, and the opening night at Royal Greenwich must have been about between 1970 and 74, because I remember Edward Heath was the Prime Minister. And some way I'd persuaded Edward Heath to come to this with the Spanish Prime Minister. So we have the opening of this show with the British Prime Minister, the Spanish Prime Minister at Royal Greenwich. And this year, I'm no fool. I know the weather can be not very good in August. A tarpaulin roof. No corrugated iron for me. On the night in question, the greatest wind that London has known in 100 years, it lifted the tarpaulin from its moorings. The tarpaulin flew into the air and it fell, literally, on top of the heads of the two prime ministers and their bodyguards.
No!
Yes. They immediately got their bodyguards, ripped the tarpaulin off. The prime ministers were rushed into their cars and swept away. The rest of the performance was cancelled. So that is how I killed Sonne Lumière. Now, the point of the story is this. My friend Colin Sanders, who was my partner in this venture, founded a company called Solid State Logic. Using the keyboards, the desks, to operate the lighting and the sound, that we had created together. We had owned this company together. The point of the story is, I said, this is going nowhere, you're going nowhere, it was a £100 company, you keep the rest of it, I'm off. 8 years later, he sold the company for £70 million.
No!
And that was in the 1970s, when £70 million pounds was worth £70 million.
Wow.
Yep. True story. He very kindly... He did invite me, because when I had another business venture...
To his island?
Even better. I think he invited me to Verona in his private jet. In his private jet! Yes. And I went, even though it terrified me.
You really have looked the proverbial gift horses in the mouth.
I have.
And then walked away.
I'm not a very good business person. But the reason that I survive, well, this is what people say to me, why at your age, Charles, are you still working? And I explain, I need the money. I've got 3 children, 7 grandchildren, you know, I've discovered over the years, money is the one thing keeping me in touch with them. So I've got to go on earning. And so I'm a freelance. You're a freelance, aren't you?
Yes, I am, yeah.
Yeah.
I work because I love it, and I'm very lucky to be able to say that. And I'm guessing that for all that you've just said, actually, you still love it, Charles. This is what you love to do. Would you be happy flying around with spreadsheets in the back of your own private jet? I don't know. Would you?
No, I wouldn't. I'd be frightened of the private jet. I wouldn't want a helicopter. I've looked at the detail. Tragically, my friend, Colin Sanders, died in a helicopter accident after a night flying lesson, which is a tragedy. He was a great man. So his story has a sad ending, though I'm lucky that I know his widow and love her, and we're still good friends. I wouldn't want to be with the spreadsheets in an aeroplane. I'm not very good with money, which is why I was so happy when I was at the Treasury. Surrounded with people who weren't very good with money either. Yes. But that's a different story. No, I like working because when I was a little boy, I was at a school and the headmaster, Mr. Stocks, remember his name? You know, we all have these teachers, don't we, in our lives? We call them Mr. Stocks or Miss So-and-so, Mrs. So-and-so. Anyway, Mr. Stocks, I remember him saying to me, I can see where I was standing and where he was sitting when he said this. He was an old headmaster. He was 80 years old. And he said, Brandreth, I've just got one thing to say to you, one thing for you to remember in life. And it was this. And I think it's just five words. Busy people are happy people. Mm. That's all he said. Busy people are happy people. And I remember that, and that's been my experience. So, like you, you're lucky enough to be busy. I'm lucky enough to be busy. Yeah. And we're lucky enough to be paid for our work. You call it work. I mean, you know, hardly call what I do work, but I certainly turn up.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Are you ready for your third and final question?
Oh, well, there's one more question. Yes, I am.
There's one more. I know that you are, as we've established, able to wax lyrical on pretty much any subject. But what I'd love to hear more about from you is your life and times spent living on Baker Street. It's a street that has been made famous in song, made famous by having a very famous resident, Sherlock Holmes. But it's a street that you called home for the best part of your life, really, didn't you?
Well, I now see why your podcast is so successful. I couldn't understand how it had so many downloads and views. I thought, you know, what's this about? Because you're asking interesting questions and you get me, somebody like me, off automatic pilot. Because...
I will take that as a compliment, Charles. Thank you.
Well, it's intended as one. It's giving me time to think about Baker Street. Baker Street has been part of my life, almost the whole of my life. When I was a little boy, my parents lived in two blocks of flats. I was brought up in London, and I lived in mansion flats. They were called mansion flats, built in the late Victorian, Edwardian era. And my father was born in 1910, almost an Edwardian. He was actually born just after Edward the Seventh had died. But the Victorian Edwardian era has always meant a lot to me. My father almost... the reason I talk in this plummy way is because that's how my father talked. And I think he talked like his father talked. And we lived in these Edwardian Victorian flats with high ceilings. And I remember vividly moving to the one in Baker Street because the first literary love of my life was undoubtedly the works of Arthur Conan Doyle, the Sherlock Holmes stories. Mm. And I found I had a bedroom that overlooked 221B Baker Street. We were told. That's where we believed it was.
Yeah.
I now reckon it was a little bit... It's where the Abbey National Building used to be. I now reckon, having done more research into Sherlockian studies, it was probably somewhere else along Baker Street. But that meant a great deal to me, the idea of being there. And my parents then moved into another block of flats called Chiltern Court. Where there, funnily enough, that's an interesting block. It's the block immediately above Baker Street Tube Station. Interesting people have lived in that block. Arnold Bennett, who wrote my favourite novel called The Old Wives' Tale in 1904, one of the great years in the history of literature. I think Chekhov wrote The Cherry Orchard that year. I think J.M. Barrie created Peter Pan that year, one of the greatest plays ever written. It's informed my entire life. Who do you think you are? Tinkerbell? No, I think I'm Peter Pan. I don't want to grow up. I'm totally happy being still quite childlike. Being childish is a different matter. But anyway, 1904, brilliant year. So Arnold Bennett lived there. I think H.G. Wells lived there for a while. And in the flat next door to us lived Huey Green. You heard
no
of Huey Green?
No way.
Huey Green. Knox Huey Green, who also, we later discover, the father of
Paul Yates.
Paul Yates. Yes.
Yes.
Bizarre.
But he was kind of, gosh, who would you say he is the today's equivalent? Well, he was kind of like Anton Deck in one, wasn't he?
He was.
He was the host
Anton
of Opportunity Knocks, which was the Britain's Got Talent of his day.
It was. And yeah. He hosted a number of shows like that. He was Canadian by birth, and he loved model railways. I wasn't interested in model railways, but my younger brother, I had a brother who was 10 years younger than me, loved the model railway. And Huey Green, who was always very nice with us, very friendly, very pleasant, like a nice uncle, he allowed my brother to spend hours looking at Huey Green's train set. He was never allowed to touch it, but he could watch Huey changing the points and polishing the engines, and so my brother could just stand there observing.
Staring on. Wow. I mean, it was quite the neighbourhood, wasn't it, Giles? It really was, because you then had the Beatles open the Apple... Was the Apple Store? It's not the Apple Store as we know it now.
At the corner of Chiltern Street and Baker Street, they opened a shop called the Apple Shop, I think.
Yeah.
And it had an apple, but without not looking like the current Apple logo. Though I think there was some agreement between Apple, their record company,
and Apple. It wasn't dissimilar.
Right at the beginning. It wasn't dissimilar, and I think they came to terms about it many, many years ago. I say that because I have a son who is an intellectual property lawyer and has his finger on the pulse when it comes to these things. But that is how I managed to meet the Beatles. I mean, my life has been one... People think this is ridiculous when I love name-dropping, but I do it partly as a joke, partly to send myself up, but also because I think it's really quite exciting.
It is. You grew up looking in the bedroom window of what you thought was the residence of Sherlock Holmes. You were living in the same block as Huey Green, and then you were shopping at the Beatles store while the Beatles were there. I mean, everything was tangible to you. That must have made, as a child that was raised in the country, the only thing I had that was close to that was Eddie the Eagle Edwards in the Cotswolds.
Oh, it's marvellous.
They're not comparable, Giles.
But did you meet him? Did you meet Eddie? Oh, you didn't even meet him? He and I were old muckers.
Lovely.
One of the joys of being at TVM in the 1980s is you met everybody. Everybody came through the doors at TVM. So I met Eddie the Eagle. And I remember the day sitting on the sofa at TVM. There was me, Roland Ratt, and Willy Brandt, the Chancellor of West Germany. The three of us on the sofa at the same time. Ridiculous, but glorious.
This is what I mean. Your wonderfully ridiculous life. And I think so much of your appetite for it must have come surely from being a resident of Baker Street, where all of this was on your doorstep.
It was. It was right in the centre of London. There was also at one end, there was a bookshop called Bumpus Books, where you could buy wonderful books. And at the other end was Regent's Park. And I would go to the open air theatre in Regent's Park, and that's where I fell in love with open air Shakespeare. Well, I already loved Shakespeare. I just started seeking the open air. You know, it was opened. It was reopened by Sir John Gielgud, lovely actor, great classical actor. I might tell you my story about Glenda Jackson, who was a marvellous woman.
We lost last week. What a huge shame.
Great shame, but what a life. What a life.
What a woman.
What a person. I mean, she was extraordinary.
Human being she was, eh?
She was a fabulous human being. We'll talk more about her. And I really liked her, and she got on quite well with me. And it's interesting that we got on so well, because she was a very serious human being. Anyway, so John Gielgud, when Glenda and I invited him for lunch on his 90th birthday to the House of Commons, because we were both MPs at the time, he came 90 years of age, ramrod back, wonderful posture. But he was a curious mixture, really. He was both a Roman senator and an Edwardian dandy at the same time. And we said to him, you know, Sir John, we are so honoured that you, the great classical actor of the 20th century, should choose to come and have luncheon with us on your 90th birthday. He said, oh, my dears, I'm delighted. You see, all my real friends are dead. She lived a long and a full life, and it was a privilege to know her. And with some people I know well, I don't claim a great intimacy with Glenda, but we became allies at the House of Commons because we became MPs on the same day in 1992. And because, of course, she was a great international film star, Oscar winner, double Oscar winner, I think, Emmy winner, Tony Award winner, and I was a bit of a daytime TV person. But we were both outsiders. And we arrived there, and it was like arriving at a kind of Victorian boys' public school. And because she was so famous, I think a lot of people on her side, the Labour people, weren't very comfortable about approaching her. And so she was a bit of a loner, and I was a bit of a loner. And we found ourselves taking tea together, and she couldn't bear it. We would go into the tea room, and all the Labour people would sit at one end, and all the Conservatives at another end. And it was the same in the dining room as well. She thought, this is ridiculous. And she hated the chamber because of all the yaboo that went on. So we formed a kind of friendship. And then because I knew she admired Sir John so much and she loved Shakespeare, we had that in common as well.
I think you were also quite, I think you shared an appetite for disruption in as much as you were able to go in and disrupt conversations for it, or just disrupt the status quo. Because as you've just said, you know, there were the two of you sat together, two different political parties that you represented, with Conservatives at one end of the room and her Labour MPs at the other. But you two came together.
She was very shocked about that until I told her, but don't worry, the Liberal Democrats, they wait at table. She thought that was quite funny. She didn't like them much either. But she was she was a political animal, though. She was passionate about it.
She was a change maker.
In an impressive way. Yeah. She was a change maker. My only contribution, really, a couple of contributions. One was one day when I was working at the Department of National Heritage, now called Culture, Media and Sport. I walked through Trafalgar Square and saw that empty plinth. And I thought we could put something on that. And as a result of that, we now have all those wonderful, well, some people think some of them are wonderful, some of them aren't, but they're changing sculptures on the plinth.
Were you part of the team that Dame Prulith was?
It was my idea to bring on Prulith. I went into the department.
She spoke about this when she came on the show recently, Giles.
Well, there
That's
you
really
are.
Really interesting. We
gave her that job. I came into the department one day and said, there's this empty plinth. And I did all my jokes about, you know, who's going to be Plinth Philip or Plinth Charles on it. All that. And I asked the permanent secretary, I said, you know, what can you tell us? Are we responsible for this square? And he said, yes. And it's been empty since Victorian times. And I said, well, could we put something on it? And he said, well, it's got to be a historic figure. I said, what about Margaret Thatcher? That did not go down well. He said, well, you can see it's Trafalgar Square, military league, Nelson's. I said, well, what about Margaret Thatcher in her tank in the Falklands? He didn't like that idea at all. So then I thought, well, maybe in the fullness of time, it might be that the Queen, the late Queen Elizabeth II, would be there in her uniform, you know, as Drooping of the Colour. And so I thought, in the interim, what can we do? And so we thought, let's get a team together to think about this. And at the time, Prue Leith, who I knew, had just become the president or the chair of the Royal Society of Arts and Manufacturers. It's called the RSA, the Royal Society of Arts, but it actually is in manufacturers. And we gave it to her and her team, and they came up with the idea of this rotating series of artworks. So, yes. Beautiful. So that's a nice thing.
And that's something she remains, you know, as she was talking to me in her 83rd year, 83, 84, she talked about that as one of her great achievements. So,
it is a great achievement.
Yeah.
Well done. Well done her. She seized the opportunity that we gave her, and we're very lucky.
But well done you too.
She looks so good. Yes. Yes, actually.
For finding the right person for the job. There you go.
My other little claim to fame is, again, when I was an MP, same time as the plinth, I introduced the 1994 Marriage Act, which is the legislation that for the first time enabled people in England to get married in a civil wedding outside a register office. Until then, you had to be in a register office. Now, stately home, castle, historic house. That was my private members bill, piece of legislation that I introduced. So those are
very nice too. Well, look at the impact that's had. Because you were married not far from where you were born and raised. You got married around the corner
in Baker Street. We lived when my wife and I got bought our first flat. It was just off Baker Street.
How extraordinary that you took her home.
Wait for this. We bought the flat, and then the doorbell rang, and somebody said, is this the apartment where the great T.F. Eliot lived? I said, you mean T.S. Eliot, the poet? They said, yes. The flat we bought turned out once to have been the home of T.S. Eliot.
Oh, I bet you thought you'd died and gone to heaven.
Well, almost, but not quite. Because, again, when I was 7 years of age, and a server at a church called St. Stephen's in Gloucester Road, another part of London, one of the sidesmen was T.S. Eliot. And when I'd read the lesson at the Christmas Carol concert as a little boy, the vicar, there was a high Anglican church, Father Howard, he was called, Father Howard, introduced me to T.S. Eliot and said, this is the great poet T.S. Eliot, who made conversation with me. And I asked him about his poetry, because I was a well-brought-up child. And obviously he didn't talk about any of his great poems, but he talked about his Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats. And he encouraged me to learn one of the poems. And so for T.S. Eliot, I learnt Macavity. Macavity's a mystery cat. He's called the Hidden Paw, for he's the master criminal who can defy the law. He's the battlement of Scotland Yard, the flying squad's despair, for when they reach the scene of crime, Macavity's not there. And I performed that first for T.S. Eliot himself.
And you still remember it?
I do.
Giles, I struggle to remember what I had for breakfast. You're amazing. Well done.
Well, I tell you, learning poetry by heart's a wonderful thing. And I have a project now. I'm going to plug anything. Should really be plugging my new podcast, starting later in the year with an intriguing name, Rosebud. That's all. I just lay it there. People can think about it. Won't be till the autumn that you discover what it means. But I will mention this. A project I've got called Poetry Together, where we get children, school-age children, to learn a poem by heart, like I did, Macavity. And then we get old people, like T.S. Eliot was in his 70s then, to learn the same poem by heart. And we then bring the old people in their care homes, together with the young people from their schools, where they have tea, cake, and they have a poetry slam. They perform the same poem together at the same time. And we've been doing this for about 10 years now.
Poetry slam, that's great.
And it's fantastic. We did one a few years ago at the Army Museum, and there was an old soldier in his 90s who did a war poem by Siegfried Sassoon with a 13-year-old boy. They took alternate lines. It was so moving. And it's fantastic. And we do this, and we've been wonderfully supported by Queen Camilla, who came 1 year, and she did Hilaire Belloc's poem Matilda, about a naughty girl called Matilda, with a group of 7-year-olds. She'd learnt it by heart. I mean, it's a very good way to get to sleep, to try and remember the poems from your childhood and repeat them. And to learn new poems, it's a fantastic way of, you know, there's research that shows when you get to my age, you can help your synapses keep supple by learning poetry by heart.
It's a workout, isn't it, for the mind?
Yeah.
Brilliant. You are endlessly fascinating, Giles. And I really hope that you don't ever slow down or say no to opportunities that come your way, because there's very few people that can kind of turn their hands to anything, and you are absolutely one of them. I've also really enjoyed reading some of your book, Elizabeth, An Intimate Portrait, looking at the life of our late monarch. And I would encourage people, if you do have any interest in the history of the royal family, to go to your work, because you're so well connected and you love it and you write so beautifully. So thank you very much for finding an hour to come and answer three thought-provoking questions with me today.
Well,
it's been my
absolute
pleasure.
Thank you, Kate, for taking me occasionally out of my comfort zone. Because if anyone has bothered to listen to the end of this, you will know, if you've heard me before, that I've said things today that I don't normally say. She's taken me, out of my comfort zone. Oh.
For more insightful chat with great raconteurs, why not dive into our back catalogue, where you'll find episodes with fellow language lover Tom Reed Wilson, Alistair Campbell, Jess Phillips MP, comedian Adam Hills, Al Murray, Bonnie Langford, who you heard Giles mention there, Christopher Biggins is also in our back catalogue, Emma Barnett, and the poet Lem Sisse. And I'll be back with you for another midweek mini episode on Tuesday with something from the cellar, some vintage cuts from some of our vintage guests, all residing in the White Wine Question Time cellar. And don't forget, there'll be a brand new episode dropping next Friday. Until then, thanks for your company.
White Wine Question Time is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
The championship season is over, and what a season it was.
But the best is yet to come. It's the playoffs.
Who will make it to the Premier League?
And who will be left heartbroken at Wembley?
Stay across it all with The Second Tier.
We're bringing you episodes after every leg.
And in between, we're revisiting the greatest moments in playoff history.
It's real conversation with two real championship obsessives.
So you can be in the know about everything happening in the playoffs.
And share all your new knowledge in the pub with your mates.
So come join us.
We're your one-stop shop for the playoffs.
Search Second Tier in your podcast app
and hit subscribe.